for you to open your Bibles to Mark chapter 9, where we had our scripture reading this morning. I believe that was page 680 in the Pew Bible. Earlier in chapter 9, we find the story of the transfiguration of Jesus, where Jesus had gone up to a high mountain, and he went with Peter, James, and John, and they were privileged to be able to see this wondrous expression of the favor and the glory of God that came upon Jesus. But it says in verse 3 of Mark 9 that Jesus' clothes became shining, exceedingly white like snow, such as no launderer on earth can whiten them. And of course, if you know the story, Peter becomes so overwhelmed by what he sees that he makes a proposal that altars should be built and tabernacles should be built to Moses and Elijah and Jesus. And then God speaks from heaven and basically says, "That's a bad idea, Peter." But he doesn't say it that way. He says, "Really, what you need to do is pay attention to my son." In verse 7, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved son, hear him." We've got technicians in the back. We might need a picture here before long. From that great triumph of Jesus, this wonderful experience of being on the mountain and God approving of Jesus, Jesus then comes down from that great triumph to a situation of, I suppose, tragedy wouldn't be too strong of a word. First of all, Jesus comes down from the mountain to find a situation of suffering that had been brought to the disciples. A man has a son, and in fact, Luke says it's his only child, who is demon-possessed. And the condition of this son is, in a word, horrible. We read about that later on in chapter 9. It says in verse 18 that whenever he seizes him, he throws him down, he foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. The demon takes control of the child's body and begins to treat that body in the most horrible way. And then it says in verse 20, they brought the child, and it says, "When he saw him, immediately the spirit convulsed him, and he fell on the ground and wallowed, foaming at the mouth. And he asked the father, 'How long has this been happening to him?' And he said, 'From childhood.'" Now, you may or may not have a child with some sort of ongoing ailments, but you know the kind of stress that it brings if, in fact, you are in that situation. And this is just a horrendous circumstance. And nothing has given this man or his son relief. Verse 22, "And often he's thrown himself both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." So Jesus comes down from the Mount of Transfiguration, this wonderful triumph of the approval of God, glowing in the glory of heaven, and he comes rather quickly back to the reality of life on this earth. And it's one that's not pretty. It's an illustration of suffering and the horrible effects that Satan has on us in this world. Well, he also comes down from the mountain to find that his disciples have failed to give this man any kind of help and any kind of relief. And that certainly has to be disappointing, and we'll say that something more about that in a moment. But Jesus also comes down to find controversy is ongoing between his disciples and the scribes because they're seizing upon this failure as an opportunity to undermine Jesus and his influence. And there's this dispute going on, I suppose, as to the failure of what's taken place and perhaps the implications of that. But nonetheless, just contrast the first part of Mark 9 and the second part of Mark 9. What a come down, as it were, for Jesus. What disappointment to be in the presence of great men of faith of old, and even of God Himself, and Peter, James, and John, His contemporaries, and then come down to this situation as He finds it. I'd like to suggest to you that what we find happening later on in this chapter really is a crisis or a question of belief. First of all, the father of the child has his own crisis to deal with. He has come to the other nine disciples, Peter, James, and John being absent with the Lord, and he's made his appeal to them that they might help him. In Mark chapter 9, verses 22 and 23, we read part of this a moment ago, after explaining what's going on with the condition of the child, he says, "If you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." You notice he's not asking of Jesus, "If you will," he's asking, "If you can." And I would suggest that likely this man's confidence in what might be done for his son has been shaken. It's been shaken by the failure of the disciples. And here's a man with his son of a lifelong condition, and nobody's been able to help him yet. And whatever he knew, whatever he had heard about the disciples of the Lord, or the Lord Himself, he had come to them looking for some kind of help, and they weren't able to give it either. And so the man now is in a position of wondering whether anything can be done even by Jesus. "If you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And that idea that's in the word help carries with it some desperation. He is desperately seeking for help in this matter. And Jesus replies in verse 23, turning the tables on the man, "If you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes." The question really is not, can Jesus help? Jesus can. But Jesus is wanting to cause this man to peer into his own heart and soul and ask a hard question of himself. What is the degree of your belief? How strongly do you believe in me and in the power of God? And the man responds in verse 24, "Immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, 'Lord, I believe, help my unbelief.'" The answer, on the one hand, seems contradictory. I believe, and I don't believe. Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. And yet, I think any of us who are believers in God can identify to some degree with what this man is saying. And I believe, certainly, that belief exists in various degrees, from the demons on the one hand, to a man like Abraham on the other hand, who is the father of the faithful by virtue of the quality of faith that he himself had in God. But I'm sure there are times when we have all felt a similar sentiment to this man. Yes, I believe, but I'm not sure my belief in this situation is as strong as it should be. And recognizing that deficiency, the man cries out if Jesus would in fact not only help his son, but help him in his own unbelief. So, the father has a crisis of faith, but the disciples, I suggest to you, are also having their own crisis of faith. If you understand this story in its chronological flow, taking into account Mark chapter 6, the disciples have already cast demons out of people. They've already been sent out by Jesus. And they were healing the sick, and they were casting demons out of men. And yet they come upon a situation that is over their head. And in fact, they come to Jesus in verse 28 of Mark 9 and ask, "Why could we not cast them out?" And Jesus says in verse 29, "This kind can come out by nothing but prayer and fasting." Apparently drawing a distinction between this demon possession and others. And whatever we understand about demon possession, apparently there's a gradient. And this kind of a demon is something that takes some special treatment and special faith. But I want you to notice from Matthew 17 and verse 20, a parallel account of this, that's not all Jesus said to the disciples when they said, "Why could we not cast the demon out?" Jesus also said, "Because of your unbelief." because of your unbelief. Now, he says this to men who had been growing and developing in their faith in Jesus. They had seen increasingly the works of Jesus. They had heard the teaching of Jesus. They had seen all the wonderful things he was able to do. They themselves had power to cast out demons. But there's something yet missing in their own faith. And Jesus says, you failed because you lack belief. And then look at Mark 9 and verse 19. When Jesus comes down from the mountain and he sees the man and understands the nature of what's happening, he sees that his disciples have failed. And then he sees the controversy. You know, the enemies of Jesus were always there, ready to seize on anything they could, ready to pounce, ready to undermine him. And he comes down and he sees all of this, and the man makes his appeal to Jesus in verse 18. Look at Jesus' response in verse 19. He answered him and said, O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him to me. I would suggest to you that when Jesus says, O faithless generation, he is referring to everybody. That is, he's referring to his disciples. I've been gone from you a very, very short period of time. And I come back, and you've demonstrated already your lack of faith. Almost carries with it a similarity to the story of Moses going up on Mount Sinai, seeing the glory of God, and coming back down to the wild party going on among the people and worshiping the golden calf. How quickly these disciples have turned from being miracle workers themselves to failing to cast out this demon. And Jesus, this is after Jesus has tried to start preparing them for his death, for his absence. How exasperated. And can you not hear the exasperation in his voice in verse 19? Oh, faithless generation. How long shall I bear with you? How long shall I be with you? First of all, I think he's disappointed in his disciples. Secondly, I think he's disappointed in the multitudes who have been drawn now to witness the spectacle going on. Jesus is already having to depart from Galilee because of opposition against him. In the very region where he had done so much work and the multitudes were with him, and now he's being chased out of Galilee by the Pharisees and the scribes and their influence. And the crowds are very fickle. And they gather to see what's going to happen now that Jesus has come back to confront the scribes who are arguing with the disciples. And I think he's put out with the scribes. He's demonstrated himself adequately before them. And they continue to disbelieve. And I think also the Father. And he addresses, again, the statement of unbelief to the Father. It's not what I can do. It's whether or not you believe. And so he's talking to people, by and large, who should have recognized him, should have been prepared for his coming. Failing that, should have been persuaded by the works that he's been doing. He's just been on the mountain receiving the accolades of God himself. This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Hear him. And he has to descend from that back into, if you will, the cesspool of unbelief. To be surrounded by and harangued by and disappointed by the lack of faith that he sees in everybody who's gathered around him. And this, I think, evokes this cry from Jesus. Oh, faithless generation. What do I have to do? But more than that, he says, how long do I have to be with you? He's clearly disappointed. Well, I'd like for us, toward the close of our lesson here, to make some observations about what transpires here. First of all, I'd like to notice with you something that grows out of the actions of the disciples. And that simply is, our failures discourage others and perhaps even cause others to blaspheme. When we claim to to be disciples of the Lord, when we claim to be those who honor Him, and as was read to us this morning from Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8, we make it known to people we're aspiring to live more godly and pure and holy lives. What we do, in effect, is we raise the expectations of other people upon ourselves. When we claim to be Christians, and as the disciples certainly, truthfully, claim to be disciples of the Lord, someone comes to them looking for help, looking for assistance, and they cannot deliver it. This is discouraging to the man. And his own faith now begins to waver. And so I'd like to exhort us, first of all, in thinking about this story, to pay special attention to ourselves, to our own lives, to what we're projecting toward other people. And perhaps to ask ourselves, is there substance behind what I project? If I'm going to talk to other people about the importance of the knowledge of the Word of God, and if I'm going to talk to other people about moral purity, and I'm going to talk to other people about being faithful to the Lord and being diligent and putting Him first in all things, am I going to be able to deliver when I'm put to the test? Am I going to be able to demonstrate when the opportunity arises that I am, in fact, what I am projecting? Because when those from the outside see our personal behavior, or when those from the outside look into a congregation of the Lord's people, and they can rightfully find fault, then we are discouraging other people and undermining the influence that we pray and strive to have among men. Second observation from this story is that men may let us down, but God won't. And it would have been a terrible mistake, which it appears this man, this father, is beginning to drift into, to ascribe the failure of the disciples even to Jesus Himself, though it would have been understandable to some degree. This man, I would think, without speculating too far, this man knows Jesus and knows the disciples and knows the reputation. Back in Mark 6, when the men are sent out, they're sent out through Galilee. And they go from town to town and city to city in Galilee, casting out demons and healing the sick and preaching the gospel of the kingdom. I don't believe it's too far-fetched at all to say that this man had some understanding of Jesus and His disciples and their power and their works, and should have rightfully thought, well, going to one of the disciples of the Lord would be as good as going to the Lord. But that expectation was proof to be an error. But Jesus, when He comes down from the Mount of Transfiguration, takes control of the situation. And when He says, "Bring him to me," He says it with authority. And I think one of the lessons we can learn from this story is that our faith and our trust must be placed well. And that means it must be placed in God, first and foremost. Yes, we're going to look to men at times for teaching, for encouragement, for help and edification, for all kinds of elements of spiritual strength. But ultimately, the faith cannot be in men. Because as is demonstrated even by disciples who had miraculous power, men can fail, and men will fail us. And if we have too much confidence in one of our brethren, and then some moral lapse comes, or we see some spiritual inconsistency, or worse than that, we see a brother or even a sister that we greatly treasure and greatly value, and they lose their faith altogether, we can be devastated by that if our faith is not placed properly. And Jesus challenges this man to return his faith and his confidence to really where it belongs, and that's in Him. The question was not whether Jesus could. He certainly could. But as Jesus so often does, He turns the situation back on the person and asks them a very penetrating question designed to reveal where their heart and their thinking really are. Well, thirdly, dependence on God is vital to the spiritual success that we're going to have in this world. Back in verse 29 of Mark 9, when the disciples came and said, what went wrong? Why could we not cast the demon out? Jesus said to them, this kind can come out by nothing but prayer and fasting. And again, tie the Matthew 17 passage together with that, because you didn't believe. And what I would gather from this is likely the disciples had come to have an overblown sense of confidence in themselves and lacked the kind of confidence and belief in God that they should have had. And then they ran into a situation that took greater spiritual resource to handle than what they had. And so Jesus says, this kind comes out by nothing but prayer and fasting. I would assume by His answer, they did not pray and they did not fast in order to call upon the power of heaven to help them do what this challenge was presenting to them. And so what is implied here, I think, is that our connection with God is vital in being spiritually successful. We're not going to do it on our own. We're going to have to depend on God and on His power, and that through belief and confidence in Him, that we can accomplish what God's wanting us to accomplish in a given circumstance. Fourthly, we must continue to do what is right, even when discouraged. And I'm saying that on behalf of Jesus in this story. Again, descend from the Mount of Transfiguration to the plains of disappointment. And yet, what does Jesus do when He comes down? He's obviously exasperated. He's obviously discouraged by His response. And yet He sees a man in tremendous need. And I don't know what we might have done in that situation, but perhaps in similar circumstances, we might be weakened by what's going on around us. We might lose our enthusiasm for doing what God would have us to do. And that's a very human reaction. When we look around ourselves and we see a lack of faith or a lack of activity or a lack of trying in those around us, it can affect us. And we might decide, well, what am I going to do? Nobody else really seems to be involved in what's happening here. And it's just so easy to be taken off by the influence of those around us. And yet Jesus comes down from the mountain, sees the pitiful young boy and says, bring him to me. I'll deal with it. Frustrated as he is, it doesn't interfere with his responsibility to do what's right. And that's true with us. Whatever may be happening around us, or whatever the failures of others, or whatever the weaknesses of others, really is all beside the point. I have responsibility. I have duty before God. I have abilities that I can contribute to the cause of the Lord. And I can't let myself sink into discouragement or depression because I look around and see failure. Let me ask you, when is that ever going to be any better? When is our environment, when is this world ever going to be any better at supporting us spiritually? There are going to be many, many times in this life we're going to feel alone spiritually because we just perhaps look around and we don't see a lot of faith and a lot of encouragement from the outside. And then finally, the euphoria of success doesn't last long. Life is an ongoing series of challenges. I'm sure you've already learned that. You know, you get these peaks in life. And when you get the peak, it's good. It's really, really good. And you just want to ride that, you know, as long as you can. I don't feel any sense of discomfort. I don't have a severe challenge in life that I'm aware of. There's no great circumstance of unhappiness hanging over my head. Everything about my life is in balance so far as I can see it. I'm really, really happy. Boy, you want to milk that for all it's worth. Because the older you get, the more you realize it just doesn't tend to stay that way very long. Speaking of external circumstances. And again, here's Jesus enjoying great glory on the one hand, and then descending back to the sinful world, as it were, on the other. And being challenged once again by a circumstance that causes Him to reach down deep inside and to respond. Life is a series not only of challenges, but it's a series of challenges that seem to get bigger as life goes on. Those of you with smaller children, the challenges may seem very great in trying to care for those children in their younger ages. It's so much of your time and attention is just placed, you know, into their physical care. And you might think, well, you know, when they get a little bit older, this is going to get better. You know, when I don't have to do diapers and I don't have to put every, you know, spoonful of food in their mouth, when I don't have to help them take every step that they're taking, this is wearing me out. Things are surely going to get better when they get older. Where do I go with that now? I've got kids in the audience. Teenagers. They're good kids. The challenges just get bigger. They get more serious. And it's not just with children. It's just simply what is being demanded of us in life. Economically, the challenges get bigger. The sense of responsibility as we get to our middle age and we then consider our families if we're to be gone, those challenges get bigger and more serious. There's always another challenge. And so as we draw the lesson to a close, let me ask you this. What is your next biggest challenge in life? The answer to that is A. You don't have a clue. And neither do I. But whatever it may be, do you have the faith in God to deal with it? The disciples, I suppose, were caught blindsided. The father had an ongoing problem and was desperate for some help. Jesus has his own challenge in coming down from the mountain. We don't know what our next challenge is in life. But what we do know, to some degree, is what kind of faith I have to meet it. And whether or not I am as strong as I need to be, whatever comes down the pike. Because this world has a way of throwing us things that we're just not ready for and we didn't see coming. And yet we're called upon to respond. We're called upon to be faithful. We're called upon to be obedient. We're called upon to stand up and be the people that we claim to be. Whatever that next challenge is. And if you're not a Christian at all, how are you doing with the challenges of life? On whom are you leaning? Who do you seek help from when life gets really tough? We want to extend to you the Lord and a relationship with Him as offered to us in His Word. That relationship is open and available to everyone. And we extend the invitation of Him this morning to come to Him if in fact you've not done so. Are you ready for the challenges? If you are a Christian, are you as strong as you think you need to be for what may come next? There's something we can help you correct before we leave our assembly today. The invitation is extended to you, and we'd be glad to help you while we stand and sing.